Look up idiot in the dictionary. You know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important, and thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring the films of François Truffaut, as recommended by Robert Hornack, and this week's episode, I'll be talking about Truffaut's 1960 film, Shoot the Piano Player. I should also preface that once again, joining me for this podcast is my faithful Radiator Bubbleguts, who is doing his thing over there in the corner, trying to keep me warm on this frigid New York City February evening, Valentine's Day, I should say. Happy Valentine's Day to those of you who, well, I guess I can't say are celebrating it, because by the time this podcast goes up or that you listen to it, you will not be currently in the throes of celebration unless it was either a very good evening for you or a very terrible evening for you. Either way, I hope it was, if you chose to partake, I hope it was successful, I hope it was memorable, I hope it was loving and warm for you. If you chose to not celebrate, then I hope that your Tuesday and or Wednesday went well as you chug along, through the work week. Well, here we are at the second film, Shoot the Piano Player, and before I kind of get into it, I want to reference something which is happening off mic, in which my good friend Robert Hornack and I are kind of continuing the conversation on François Truffaut and his significance specifically outside of the context of the French New Wave, because if you listen to the 400 Blows episode, then you know that what I said about that film was that it was a very good film, but it wasn't a great film because of the inability for it to... That makes it sound like it was a flawed film. I was very entertained by the 400 Blows, but I think what I was generally trying to say was that what stops it from elevating to greatness, to timelessness, is the fact that if you remove it from the context of the French New Wave and what the French New Wave filmmakers were trying to do and are doing, they're not doing this anymore. But if you sort of... If you don't have that context, if you don't know what's going on with that, then the 400 Blows sort of loses a lot of its significance, because the phrasing that I think I used when I was talking to him about it was, you know, let's say the French New Wave was a revolution in filmmaking. In order to kind of make sense of a revolution, you first have to know what they're rebelling against. And if you don't know what they're rebelling against, then you kind of lose some of the context of what makes these films so great. Why is the editing in Breathless revolutionary? Why is the following of a somewhat unreliable narrator, juvenile delinquent, why was that significant? You know, without realizing why these things are significant, it doesn't really stand on its own, you know, to kind of have the power that it has. And so that's the conversation we've had going back and forth, which is he is politely so, I should say, disagreeing with me. And yet, the more I'm talking to him about it, and the more I'm... also, if you are paying attention to the ID Movies Badly Facebook page, I posted a very brief article today from a listener, and I'm apologizing if I'm going to pronounce your name wrong. It's just a thing that I do. I believe it's Mr. David Lichty. If it's not Lichty, I apologize. But he sent me... He commented on the 400 Blows... Or no, the Introduction to French New Wave episode on BattleshipRetention.com. And he listed a lot of short articles to sort of read and kind of get some context and understanding of the French New Wave. One of which I posted on the I Do Movies Badly Facebook page. So go to Facebook.com/IDoMoviesBadly and read it. It's very brief. But it essentially kind of talks about the context that I was referring to with the 400 Blows episode of what French cinema looked like, and specifically the tradition of quality, I believe, is what they refer to it as, in which people were putting design over ideas or over structure. And so there was a formalism to it, which these French filmmakers of the French New Wave were very much trying to break out of. They weren't concerned with form; they were concerned with story and with genre and with character. And that was it's fleshed out a little bit in that article. And the more that I've had a conversation back and forth with Robert, and the more that I've read about stuff, I kind of realize it still goes back to Jean-Luc Godard for me, in the sense of I still am expecting certain films to sort of be like Breathless or be like Godard in the sense of he's kind of trying to reinvent the wheel, basically. And Truffaut doesn't seem like, not that he's not interested in that, but he's not saying like, hey, I want to do, let me see what came before us and let me do the opposite of that. Let me shatter archetypes. Let me shatter confines. You know, that happens to a certain extent, but not because, or at least it doesn't seem like he's doing that because he wants to be a revolutionary. This is something that Robert said and something that I keep coming back to is Truffaut just wants to make the kind of movies he wants to see. And when it came to the 400 Blows, it was something, you know, with a protagonist that he could relate to because, well, it's a thinly veiled disguise, not disguise, but it's essentially him in the lead, or a surrogate for him. And it's fun and it's jovial and it's freewheeling and sure, it kind of abandons what we sort of know of film structure and of what we've come to expect from a protagonist, but he's not doing that because he's saying, I want to revolutionize the industry or I want to make my name or there seems to be certainly a pretentiousness and a self-seriousness to Godard, and Truffaut doesn't have that. And I think really I kind of on reflection is like there's some form of cinematic PTSD that I'm dealing with when it comes to how Jean-Luc Godard's name and reputation hangs over the French New Wave and hangs over filmmaking. And I've had a few people kind of comment on me that kind of says, like, yeah, fuck that guy. Or at least Godard is not the best thing that came out of the French New Wave. It is Truffaut or it's Romer or it's Alain René or it's these other filmmakers, whereas Truffaut was kind of the guy that, you know, it's either associated with him or Truffaut, but it's kind of, I think it gets attached to Godard because obviously Godard lived a lot longer. And I think, especially when it comes to Shoot the Piano Player, this is not a film which is trying to revolutionize anything. Like it's sort of, or it doesn't aim to break down boundaries of anything, but it changes things, but it does so in sort of a gleefully different way, or Truffaut tries to make a film and it turns out different, but it's not because, like I said, it's not because he's trying to pave a path. He's just saying like, hey, I want to make the kind of movies that I want to see, and the kind of movies that I want to see are fun and are based on genre and have complex characters and can homage other movies, and that's what he kind of tries to make. And so he doesn't make something which is necessarily revolutionary, but he makes something that is different, and he does it because he's pursuing a passion, because he loves what he's doing. I waffled back and forth. I don't want to say that Shoot the Piano Player is a bloated film, but it's certainly an ambitious film, at least in regards to how it is telling a story of a complex character, sort of not jumping back and forth through time, but certainly has an element of flashback, and we dwell on the past a little bit, but a complex character who has complex emotions, and it explores those complexities through exploring different genres. I say that the 400 Blows was a jovial film, but the 400 Blows was sort of jovial with its tone, in the sense of how playful its characters were, in the sense of how seriously they took life, which, you know, wasn't that seriously at all. I referenced the specific scene where the gym teacher is marching the students down the street, and like, you know, pair by pair they kind of break off, and it's a very silly scene. 400 Blows was jovial because of its tone, because of how it wanted to paint this world that her character was in, but Shoot the Piano Player is jovial with genre, in the sense of how to accommodate, like I said, accommodate the moods and the ebbs and flows of this character's life and his attitudes. It plays with genre. It doesn't stick to just one genre. It is sort of a delightful chimera of certain things. And the conclusion that I kind of came to, and I can't say this is entirely original, Robert touched on this in the introductory episode that we had, that if we kind of remove ourselves from this preconceived notion, at least the preconceived notion that I had about the French New Wave being a bunch of people who are trying to get together and trying to revolutionize things and purposely breaking down barriers and trying to be intentional about doing the opposite of everything that came before them. If we break away from that and just kind of simplify it, which I realize is might be a little bit too simple, but if we just simplify it to this idea of it was just a bunch of young, excited filmmakers who wanted to make the kind of movies that they wanted to make, then I think that I should add on to that the kind of movies that they wanted to make in regards to wearing their influences on their sleeves, homaging Hollywood and working within genre and kind of breaking out of a stuffy mold. If we get to that idea, if we condense it down to that idea, then I think Shoot the Piano Player is actually a purer form of the French New Wave sensibilities than the 400 Blows is, which isn't to say that I think it's necessarily a better or more important film, but it certainly is more of a picture of what Truffaut and what these young filmmakers were trying to set out to do. I was certainly more entertained by Shoot the Piano Player than I was the 400 Blows, but there does seem to be a level of importance of the 400 Blows, and I guess that's just because of how much I've heard about it. That might just be inherent bias because of everything that's been sort of piled onto the 400 Blows. I'm wondering if I had seen Shoot the Piano Player first when I was young and in college and that sort of thing, if the roles would be reversed. But when I think of Shoot the Piano Player, one of the first things that I thought about was in order to kind of so we mentioned how I don't think the 400 Blows can necessarily stand on its own. You couldn't necessarily just kind of show it to someone and kind of say, like, hey, you know, what do you think of this? And if they're removed from context, they're like, I don't know, it's weird and it's kind of rambly and I'm not really sure what to think about it. But I think that average Joe, that same person, would be able to connect with Shoot the Piano Player a little bit better, especially if that person is an avid Quentin Tarantino fan. And now I know that Tarantino was somewhat influenced by French filmmakers. Certainly Reservoir Dogs came from, if not a movie he loved, then sort of a mispronunciation or a misrepresentation of the French title of, I'm not even going to try and pronounce what movie it is. Certainly, if you are movie buffs, you know what I'm talking about, so that we can just move on from that. But I was reminded of a Quentin Tarantino film from Shoot the Piano Player, especially in how it is playful when dealing with serious or dark subject matter, and also how it can jump back and forth through different genres in order to serve the story that the filmmaker is trying to tell. I think that's, you know, we kind of see that in, you see that if you've seen Kill Bill, you see that if you've seen Inglourious Basterds, hell, you've seen that in Pulp Fiction, you know, the kind of number one or the our first huge exposure to Quentin Tarantino, assuming you didn't see Reservoir Dogs first. But I mean, this is a film about essentially about gangsters, about hired killers. Why do we have to have a dance sequence in the middle of this? Why do we have to jump into a different story that involves BDSM and the Gimp and all this kind of stuff? Like, it's stuff which doesn't seem like it has any place in a gangster film, and yet Tarantino makes it work. Tarantino pulls from different genres and different moods and different tones that kind of tell the story that he wants to tell, and it all works. And Shoot the Piano Player is essentially a story about a, not even brokenhearted, but a very cowardly kind of guy, a guy who's been playing it safe for his entire life because of past heartbreak, who gets caught up in... essentially, he's getting caught up in a shakedown from gangsters because of how his incompetent brother has brought him into this plot, which has gone wrong. In the hands of a different filmmaker, this could be a very tragic and very dark story, exploring Charlie/Edward's past. You know, the love that he had found, the love that he then lost when the woman that he loved and turned his back on jumped out the window, committed suicide right in front of him. That could be a scar which is carried very heavily throughout by this character throughout the entire film. And then when you introduce the gangsters, it's sort of like you could see how this could easily become, or yeah, I guess with a simple, you know, twist here and there, not even twist, but a simple tweak here and there, how Shoot the Piano Player could be a straight up film noir, like I'm talking like the really gritty kind of cynical kind, like the ones that I explored last year, like last fall on this podcast, like that kind of film noir, the really rough one, the one that's very cynical and very not happy in its outcome. But Shoot the Piano Player's, and don't get me wrong, Shoot the Piano Player does not end happily, but there are happy and joyous and not even joyous, but lighthearted moments throughout this movie, a lot of which come at the, I'm going to say, dare I say, expense of these gangsters, the ones who reminded me of a Quentin Tarantino film because they are gangsters. They kidnap Charlie. They pull a gun on him. They kidnap also the waitress that has a crush on Charlie. They pull a gun on her, and they're kidnapping them. They're in the process of kidnapping them. But while they're in the process of kidnapping them, they're having an extensive conversation about love and romance and women's underwear, and how one of these guys admitted to trying on silk women's underwear in the past, and just like, what does this even have to do with anything? And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with anything, but it just adds such a delightful element of enjoyment to it that you sort of have these incompetent gangsters to a certain extent, but just because they are certainly incompetent or they're not the most eloquent gangsters or the most hardened gangsters in the world doesn't mean that they are any less serious about what they're going to do, because this film ends with a shootout. This film includes car chases and gunfights and the sort of stuff that you would find in a film noir or a gangster movie. And there is death. There is the death of Charlie's loved one again, and that is tragic. But it gets there after eventually kind of taking us through these other different moods and the other different tones, which tie into it and which make sense because of how we're trying to explain Charlie's character. And listen, I've never seen someone jump out the window in front of me. That has never happened to me. I hope to God that it has never happened to you. But I can at least relate, and I relate a little bit too well and too painfully, to this idea of a guy like Charlie who is somewhat aloof, who is very comedic, as a sort of as a defense to protect him from what has come before him. There's a funny scene at the beginning when Charlie is walking down the street being followed by the gangsters with the waitress, and he's debating to himself, like, should I try and hold her hand? Like, no, this is stupid, you know, distract yourself. And right as he decides to try to say something, he turns to her, and all of a sudden the camera realizes that this woman is gone and she's disappeared. And its execution is very funny. But if you really start to think about it, like, that is a guy who is getting caught up in his own anxiety and in his own fear. And it's played off as funny because if we focus too much on where it's actually coming from, where it actually stems from, in the sense of Charlie being reluctant because of the love that he's lost, there's a real tinge of sadness to it. But Truffaut plays it off as funny, not to be disrespectful of it, but just to kind of highlight where this guy has arrived at versus where he comes from. It's really, truly fascinating because I know the French New Wave was interested in these complex characters and showing complex moods and showing that it's more than just a standard hero's journey, and it's more than just sort of your standard movie protagonist. These are guys and girls that feel many things, that have experienced many things, because while the French New Wave wasn't necessarily adding a documentary realism to it, they were adding kind of a narrative realism to it, in the sense of, like, these are the kind of characters that actually exist in real life. And Charlie is the kind of guy that I can fully relate to, the kind of guy who uses humor as a defense, who is aloof because he guards himself from the fact that he opened himself up once before, and that went very badly. So badly, the fact that he tries to reinvent a new identity for himself. He moves away, he gives himself a different name, he wants to escape so badly from the past that, you know, the hurt that he brought on himself, actually, because of his behavior, because of his inability to sort of to open up and be forgiving, I suppose. He wants to escape from that so bad that he develops a new identity. And along with that new identity comes maybe not even necessarily a new outlook on life, but a new approach to life. And that approach could be humor, and that approach could be sensibility. But then also having that sense of humor also opens the door to the possibility of love and affection, which we think he's going to see or at least achieve because of his relationship with this waitress at the place where he works. And this waitress ultimately, you know, also ends up suffering. She dies because of Charlie opening up to her, because of Charlie bringing her into his life, that results in her death. And that sequence at the end is so tragic because of, one, how beautifully it's shot. You know, you have these wide open shots and these wide open vistas of the snow-covered, like, kind of countryside, and then you have her getting shot and just sliding uncontrollably down this hill of snow and ice, and then Charlie and his son running over to her snow-covered body. And there's something so tragic about that contrast between not just within that scene, not just within that frame, the contrast of the horrifying nature of death framed by this absolutely gorgeous beauty of nature and of snow, but then also in the larger sense, the narrative sense of the horrifying nature of that scene in contrast with the humor and the joy and the chance that we took and the chance that Charlie took to open himself and become vulnerable, and those two things smashing together just adds to a mix of emotions that if you don't understand how you should feel, that's good. I think that's what Truffaut was intending to do, to let you know, like, or not even to let you know, but not to try and dictate to you how you should feel, but just to explore, like, hey, life is complex and there are complex emotions within it, and we see that in this character of Charlie. And one thing, not because of stylistic or anything else, but another modern film which I was reminded of, at least in regards to how it shifts into different genres, or at least it stays in the same genre but shifts into different tones, is I see it a little bit in The Handmaiden, a South Korean film, but then also another South Korean film, a film that I loved, The Wailing, which is it's a straight-up horror film, and it's about 2.5 hours long, which seems like, oh my god, why do we need that much time for a horror film about an alleged demon possession in this, you know, small backwater town in South Korea somewhere. But that film is amazing in how it shifts from kind of the protagonist also shifts from sort of this bumbling, stumbling, somewhat dark comedy to what turns out to be a very grave, very serious, very tragic horror film that really does include a lot of loss and a lot of trauma and a lot of pain and heartache. I was amazed by how the director, whose name is unfortunately escaping me at this point, how he handled that tonal shift. And it wasn't so much a shift as much as it was sort of a gradual, it was sort of a gradient, a sort of transition from one to the next, where Shoot the Piano Player jumps back and forth. You know, it's very, I say schizophrenic, but I don't say it in a bad way. Or manic might be a better idea, but I don't say it in a bad way. I think it works for Shoot the Piano Player. But I at least was reminded of this film, The Wailing, because I had seen it, you know, within, well, at least within the last year, so it was somewhat fresh on my mind, especially when it came to end-of-the-year awards things, especially when it comes to the BPs, so I was kind of reminded of that. The Wailing got a few votes for me, didn't end up getting anything nominated, but that's neither here nor there. But I just thought of that, and that idea of how a film can be very successful when it doesn't stick to a genre. And also kind of reminded me how a common complaint that I have with a lot of movies, but I think a lot of people have a complaint with, is that is a film that doesn't successfully stick to a genre or doesn't successfully stick to its tone. And that just sort of emphasizes how good of a filmmaker Truffaut was, that he doesn't stick to one tone or another, blends them seamlessly together. Not really blends them together, that kind of goes in contrast with what I just said, mixes them both together, or at least using them both to his, you know, for his purposes, and it works. That is an incredibly difficult thing to do. You know, how hard is it to write like a horror comedy, or how hard is it to direct a horror comedy? We're certainly spoiled by someone like Edgar Wright with Shaun of the Dead. But also look at like a film like Undead, which doesn't do it very well, or now The Evil Dead's pretty good, but I mean there's so many horror comedies out there which can't handle the, you know, the blending of the two tones together, because it's a very difficult thing to pull off very well, and yet you have here an example in Shoot the Piano Player of a filmmaker which is able to do it spectacularly well, to not to be showy, not to be gimmicky, but to reflect more accurately the inner life and the inner narrative and the inner the development of the character who is the protagonist of this film, and it's also like, because I remember when the film ended and we sort of have Charlie essentially ending up back where he's beginning again, at first I was sort of upset by that, until I sort of realized or remembered a quote that John August, and John August is a screenwriter who's done, I know he's done more than this, but Go, Big Fish, Tim Burton's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. John August has a thought which is sort of like a screenplay ends at one of two places, where you either reach the natural conclusion of the story, or you get to a point where if the narrative were to continue, it would just be repeating itself again. So essentially you either have a closed loop, or you have a perpetual loop, but you're only seeing one iteration or one go-around of that loop. And the way that I saw Shoot the Piano Player playing out was that latter idea. The one of if this story is going to continue, it's just going to repeat itself again, because you're going to have Charlie as the piano player. You're going to have the new waitress, which is at his restaurant now. And you're essentially going to have him repeating essentially probably the same mistakes that he made, because he opened himself up. He opened himself up once again and saw the same thing happen with, I believe her name is Claire, the waitress who ends up dying. It's a repeat of what happened before. And so I think the film ends on the implication that this is just going to continue with him. And there's something very sad and very tragic about that. Despite the fact that there are many laughs to have in this film, there's something just tragic about that. Wow, this guy is essentially kind of a prisoner of himself, and him, and he has made a prisoner. He's made a prisoner, or fate has made a prisoner of him, basically his own fate. You know, the way that he has chosen to live his life. He's kind of in this in perpetuity from now on. And there's something that's very sad about that. And I know also just doing a little bit of reading and research on the Internet Movie Database. That's IMDb for some of you people who have not mixed up the acronyms for that show, for that website in the show. That Shoot the Piano Player was critically loved, but a commercial failure. And because of that, that forced Truffaut to sort of abandon his improvisational filmmaking style that we see in Shoot the Piano Player, that we saw in 400 Blows, where he's kind of going out into the street and just kind of shooting a run-and-gun kind of style, which has a kinetic pace to it and has a real a vibrancy to it. And then went back to sort of more scripted and plotted and deliberately planned kind of filmmaking. And that's a shame that happened, because if Shoot the Piano Player is the purest form of the French New Wave sentiments that I hypothesized or talked about, then the commercial rejection of Shoot the Piano Player also sort of symbolizes or signals in such a way sort of a rejection of the French New Wave sensibilities at the same time. Which would mean that only a couple of years after it started, you know, the filmmakers have to adapt, they have to do something else, which is sort of tragic. But then also you sort of think about it that, well, look at the new Hollywood wave in the 1970s, late 1960s, early 1970s. That didn't last that long either. You can say that it arguably got kicked off with Bonnie and Clyde in 1968, 1969. But then you can also say that the death knell or the swan song of it was the blockbuster success of Jaws in what, 1974? That's not a super long time to stick around. And there were still some great, you know, new Hollywood films after that, certainly Taxi Driver in, 1976, the Godfather movies, Apocalypse Now. It wasn't as though that it ended right away, but it was certainly the signs of its demise were much earlier than I think a lot of us remember it happening. Because there was another model of something which was financially successful, and that's what people wanted to jump onto. So, it is a shame that this vision or this mentality, this attitude sort of suffered that response, because I do think this is a very enjoyable and a much more complex film than you'd initially thought. Certainly, I the more I thought about it, I was more like, wow, that was deeper than I kind of gave it credit for upon the initial pass. And I also wondered, thinking back, how much of this was the failure of this, how much of it might have been a foreshadowing for Day for Night, which I know came much later. But then I also started thinking, and I haven't asked him this yet, maybe if I remember I'll do this, if that was the reasoning behind Robert recommending these two back-to-back. Shoot the Piano Player, which is the purest form of what the filmmakers are trying to do, and then Day for Night, which seems to be a reflection on being a filmmaker and what those two things might have in common. It's an interesting thought. And I'm sure I'll address it later when I do the episode for Day for Night. And if not, somebody yell at me and remind me to address that in some form, whether it's on Facebook or whether it's on in the comment field of BattleshipRetention.com. That's pretty much what I have to say about Shoot the Piano Player. I greatly enjoyed it. I hope that you greatly enjoyed it as well. If you want to revisit it, it's easy enough for you to do so. If anyone out there has Filmstruck, this has been a great series of 2 months for you, because every film that, well, with the exception of The Mirror last month, every film that I've talked about so far has been available on Filmstruck. Shoot the Piano Player, obviously being a Criterion title, is no different. If you have a subscription to Filmstruck, you can watch it there for free. If you don't have a subscription to Filmstruck, like I don't, you can rent it or purchase it on iTunes. You can also pick it up for rental or purchase on Amazon, which is what I did. You Filmstruck subscribers, if I get a little bit more money in my pockets one day, I'm gonna sign up for that, because that's a good deal. If you have any feedback on this episode, on French New Wave, on François Truffaut, on Filmstruck, why not? You know, drop me a line. Easy enough to get in touch with me via email at youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com. Just to be clear, that is the word you, Y-O-U, and not the letter U. And gmail.com is, as I said, keep up with what's going on with not just episodes, but also little supplemental articles and that kind of stuff, and pictures and fun things on the Facebook page, facebook.com/idomoviesbadly. You can follow me on Twitter if you so desire. I don't know why you would. It's mainly just retweeting political things and random pop culture thoughts that pop into my head. But that is Nolan Fixes Teeth, as in, let's imagine Christopher Nolan was your dentist, then he would fix your teeth. That is Nolan Fixes Teeth. And of course, you can keep up with all back episodes of I Do Movies Badly on the iTunes store, with the exception of, I guess, the first five, because it only, well, the last 100, I think, is how it goes. In the annals of BattleshipRetention.com, if you go to podcasts in the drop-down menu and choose I Do Movies Badly, join in the conversation. I've actually been kind of surprised that the last few, I just checked today because I was bored at work, quite a few comments on some of my Tarkovsky episodes and a few comments on the Introduction to French New Wave episode, which I'm always very excited about, because I may be flighty and I may be flaky and I may forget to check, but when I do check, I always respond. I always respond to comments, because I love engaging with you people. Because I'm still shocked to this day that I actually have fans and people who enjoy the show. So please feel free to comment in any way, shape, or form that you like. And please don't feel free not to hold any punches. My friend Fiction Isn't Real chimed in on some old Tarkovsky episodes, and it's always a pleasure to hear from him and or her. But that does it for Shoot the Piano Player. Be sure to tune in next week, where I'll be wrapping up François Truffaut with Day for Night, and will hopefully I will be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.